Frank Church, in many, many things he did, including the Church Committee, reasserted the power of Congress to at least know about these things and have the opportunity to oppose them, including by saying, no, you can't have money to mass produce LSD.
Tom Risen is a journalist in Washington, D.C., who covers government surveillance and spy agencies. He's the co-author of the best-selling book, The Last Honest Man, The CIA, the FBI, the Mafia, and the Kennedys, and One Senator's Fight to Save Democracy, which he wrote with his father, James Risen, another journalist who spent decades covering intelligence agencies. For this episode, Tom tells me about the history of the early CIA, as well as the FBI, and the real conspiracies they were involved in. We'll learn about the CIA's attempt at mind control through their illegal MKUltra program in the 50s and 60s, as well as their violent meddling in governments around the world. We'll also hear about the FBI's attacks on the leftist groups of the 1970s as part of their COINTELPRO offensive. Tom will show us how, in 1975, one senator named Frank Church finally took them to task in an investigation full of shocking revelations about the real conspiracies that helped pave the way for the conspiracy theories so popular today. I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith, and this is American Hysteria. Hi, Tom. I am so excited to talk to you and so appreciative that you've wanted to come on the show to talk about this huge topic. So welcome.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan.
Oh, I'm so glad. I think we're going to have a lot to cover today. So I would love to start by talking about the book that you co-wrote with James Risen, with your dad, and that covered so many major parts of the Cold War, things like MKUltra and all of these different things that kind of grew out into the conspiracy theories I think that we know today. One of the big reasons I wanted to talk to you was this idea that our show sometimes is very focused on debunking conspiracy theories, but I also think it's important to talk about the fact that government conspiracies did and do exist. So I think we're going to cover some of those today and how they were exposed. So to start, would you just tell me how you got into writing a book that is about the things that The Last Honest Man is about?
Well, my father, James Risen, wrote for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times for many years. He now writes for The Intercept, and he's been covering the intelligence community for decades now. And when I first started out as a journalist, I was doing research assistance and interviews with him for his previous books about the war on terror and the Bush administration, including State of War and Pay Any Price. And they were about the CIA and the national security state related to the war on terror. And after that, I went to journalism school, became a journalist, and I continued doing reporting about national security, intelligence. And 2016, we got together and said, let's work on a book. Let's actually write it and research it and do everything together. So we wrote a couple of proposals, and he had heard about the Church Committee of 1975, the Senate investigation that was really the landmark beginning of oversight of not just the CIA, but the FBI, the NSA, military intelligence, all of it. There had never really been oversight of the intelligence community before 1975. So he had heard about this, but it's, you know, if you go back and read about the history of the agency, it's almost always mentioned as a footnote. And it's just such a landmark, crazy event. Like, it's definitely the most interesting congressional hearing ever. You know, there's others that, you know, there's a ton of hearings that get attention, you know, even these days, like the January 6th hearing that happened in the House a couple of years ago. But this is just weird. So we wanted to give it, you know, the treatment that it deserves, because it's almost always glossed over as a footnote. So we spent 5 years researching and interviewing everybody who's still around. We interviewed Vice President Walter Mondale before he passed away. He was on the committee. And Gary Hart, he was on the committee. He's the last surviving senator who served on the committee. So we did tons and tons of research about the Cold War and crammed it all into one book. It's a book that's got something for everyone. It's just an amazing story about the birth of U.S. intelligence oversight. The House and Senate Intelligence Committees exist today because of the Church Committee.
Wow. Yeah, it seems like a truly comprehensive book. And yeah, congratulations. It's been so well received, and it must have been really exciting to get this information out to the public. So let's get into the Church Committee. But first, maybe we can just set the scene. I know that right now in 1975, when this committee is starting, and in the years before, we are experiencing this kind of Vietnam syndrome where Americans are starting to distrust the government a little bit more. Watergate has happened, Nixon's resigned, and there's sort of a crisis of confidence in the American people at this point. So maybe you could take it from there.
Absolutely. Yeah. The 1960s had already happened. There had already been the scrutiny of governments. And I think that one thing that I always point out, it's kind of a cliche, but it's a generational thing. The reason that the baby boomers got so much pushback when they were pushing for civil rights and government accountability is I think there is a gigantic line down the middle of the 20th century with the people born after the First World War and the Second World War. Like, there's a staunch deference to authority that you don't even see today. That before the two world wars, people were told never to question authority. Your elders are right. The police are right. The government is right. The priest is right. Your teachers are right. Don't ask questions. Just don't do it. And in the 60s, there was a ton of pushback against that. And people were starting to question the government in a way that they had never done before. So by the 1970s, this had reached a boiling point. Vietnam had blown up in the government's faces, which they knew was going to happen. They got warnings from the CIA and they ignored them. So sometimes the CIA does its job and no one listens. happened again in the war in Iraq in 2003, by the way. People in the agency warned against it and they did it anyway. Yeah. So, yeah, 1973, the United States withdraws combat troops from Vietnam. 1975, in the middle of the Church Committee, is the fall of Saigon, by the way. It's very public humiliation for the United States. And so, like you mentioned, Watergate had happened, and there had been hearings about that. And so the Church Committee was sort of created as a response to Watergate, because it was revealed that the CIA assisted the Watergate burglars in, their burglaries and attempted surveillance of the Democratic offices in the Watergate. Some of the members of the burglars were actually former CIA agents or former CIA assets. Like, there were Cuban exiles who had worked with the agency. Howard Hunt was a former CIA agent. And so there was ties to the agency that people wanted to explore. And so they create the Church Committee in 1975, led by Senator Frank Church, who's a Democrat from Idaho. That's how long ago this was. He's the last Democratic senator from Idaho. He served in the Senate for 24 years. And wow. It was an incredibly consequential Senate career. I encourage you to read the book. It'll tell you all about it. But the committee was formed thinking, okay, we're going to look into all the stuff that Richard Nixon did. But it soon becomes clear that the CIA, created in 1947, had been doing all sorts of things to abuse the rights of Americans and abuse its power and do domestic operations, which it is explicitly not supposed to do. So it becomes clear, it becomes so much broader than they originally set out to do. And it affects presidents going back to Eisenhower and Truman. It affects Democratic and Republican presidents. And it's also a really good example of bipartisanship that is pretty rare today, because there are Republicans and Democrats on the committee who work together and say, this is important. We have to do this. Let's pressure the White House to go along. And, President Gerald Ford at this point has to disclose a lot of classified records to the Senate committee, and they get an incredible amount done in just a year. Mm-hmm. So it's just an incredibly consequential committee that just goes through decades of all sorts of crazy things done by the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, military intelligence, all of it. It's just such an explosive committee.
Well, I'm ready to get into maybe some of the specific things that this committee was revealing. And I think that the number one that everybody is always talking about, thinking about, that's still contributing today to so many conspiracy theories, rightly, in my opinion, is the MK Ultra program. So how would you just give us a primer on what exactly, I mean, we hear this, these words all the time. We hear about MK Ultra, we kind of know what it is, but can you put it in the context of what was revealed during the Church Committee hearings, as well as what exactly was happening when they were implementing this program?
Yeah, MKUltra is probably the worst thing that the CIA has ever done. And that's a pretty high bar.
Yeah.
It's the worst thing, not just because of what was done, and it was domestic and it was international, and it was, yeah, there's all sorts of reasons that it's bad. But one of the reasons that it's bad is that it was kept secret even inside the CIA. The CIA has a secret budget. To this day, it has a secret budget. The House and Senate Intelligence Committees, created after the Church Committee, are allowed to look at the budget, and they can tell the CIA, no, you're not allowed to have money for this. No, you shouldn't be doing this. Mm-hmm. But we don't get to see it. Our representatives get to see it. It's classified. We don't get to see it. It's still secret. But they had, you know, the leadership of the CIA at the time, especially CIA Director Alan Dulles, was just obsessed with this idea that you could manipulate people. So it was kept secret even inside the CIA. And the lawyers at the CIA discovered it by accident a couple of times. Mm-hmm. So that's, in my mind, that's one of the obvious reasons that it's the worst thing, is that even the CIA didn't know about it. Not most people, only a few dozen people knew about it. And it spanned 2 decades. And the thing you have to remember about the Church Committee is this is 50 years ago, in 1975 to early 1976. So we know a lot more that the Church Committee did not know about. They were frequently more right than they knew. They turned over a lot of rocks and found a lot of things. And they, you know, there's thousands and thousands of pages of reports. You know, you can go online right now and find the copies of the Church Committee reports. There's several of them. They're very, very vast. They go into a lot of detail. And people have, for decades, been researching these to do their own research, to make freedom of information requests, to dig and dig and dig and find out more. And that's what happened with MKUltra. It's a very good example of that. The Church Committee was so busy. It focused on, you know, assassinations mostly, like attempted assassinations by the CIA. Mm-hmm. But MKUltra was kind of an afterthought, so it wasn't the main focus of the committee. So they only had one person doing all the research and interviews about MKUltra. So it was decidedly, you know, it got a lot of attention in the decades since then. There was a Senate committee that followed up on it, I think, in 1977. But for the Church Committee itself, it was not a huge part of it. Mm-hmm. They had so much stuff that they had to dig into. They had to be decisive about what they were and weren't going to focus on. People wanted to keep doing research, but the leadership of the committee says, no, we have to do hearings. We have to stop. You know, the key to doing work is finishing something, no matter, even if you want to do more. So MKUltra is a good example of that. It began in World War II, and the predecessor of the CIA, the OSS, they did a truth drug experiment. I'm not going to call them experiment. I'm going to call them tests, because experiments imply that there's medical and ethical oversight, and there really wasn't any.
Yeah, or consent even. Yeah.
These were not scientific. There was no medical or ethical, you know, basis behind any of it. But it began in World War II, and Harry Anslinger, who's the head of the Bureau of Narcotics, is actually on the advisory panel for this truth drug experiment.
Wow. Wow.
So the head of the Drug Enforcement Agency knows, you know, predecessor of the DEA.
What a guest appearance from Harry. Yeah.
He knows about it.
Uh-huh. Not surprised.
So they're looking for a way to, because the thing about torture and interrogation is you can make somebody talk.
Yeah.
You just can't guarantee they're going to tell the truth. But that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to find a way to ensure that people they were interrogating were going to tell the truth. So they tested prisoners with tons and tons of intoxicants. They gave people opium. They got people drunk. They made people huff carbon monoxide and all kinds of weird stuff. And the thing that they really came out of it and during the World War II example was cannabis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they thought cannabis makes people talk. You can't really guarantee they're going to tell the truth, but it's the best they came up with. I think that they had a liquefied form of THC. like what we would call today a tincture, I think. So they gave people like a liquefied form of THC. They would dip it in a cigarette into it or something. And so that's the best that they could come up with.
Okay. All right.
But it's still not guaranteed. So after World War II, they pick it up when the CIA is created. And Alan Dulles, who had been in the OSS, he was, he was already farther on in his career by now. He had probably the most spy experience out of anybody because he had been a spy during World War I. He was a diplomat. He got caught in Europe. He's a very consequential part of the agency. He's probably the worst director ever of the CIA because he's an arrogant rich guy from an arrogant rich family. His uncle and his grandfather had both been Secretary of State. He's super connected.
Yeah.
So this is his kind of his personal obsession, and he's the one who keeps it secret inside the CIA. And this coincides with the creation of LSD. LSD is created in 1943 in Switzerland by Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, still exists today. And after World War II, they decide to pick it up again and they say, okay, let's see if we can find a way to improve on what they already did. And they start testing people, you know, prisoners in occupied Germany, you know, basically any place the army was, they would do this. This is the creation of the first black sites where they would torture and drug people just to see if they could, you know, have a more productive interrogation to see if they could guarantee that people will tell the truth. And by 1953, MKUltra begins. It grows out of the predecessor programs, and MKUltra leans very heavily into LSD. They try all sorts of weird stuff, torture, drugs. Yeah, all sorts of weird. But LSD becomes the main focus of it because it's a brand new drug. It is the most, I think to this day, it is still the most potent drug ever created. It's supposed to be even more powerful than mescaline, which is synthetic peyote.
Right. Okay.
So it's a very powerful drug and they think, hey, this is a brand new thing. Let's see if this will help us with interrogations. And it grows and grows and grows into, I think, 149 sub-projects of MKUltra over from 1953. And the last recorded LSD test is 1968. And you have to remember, LSD is legal in the United States before 1968. It is federally banned in 1968. It is banned in California in 1967. So the medical community is doing lots of tests on this too.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, rich people who could get access to a drug from Europe are doing it too. People eventually learn to cook it themselves because the laws we have today, you know, you go to a pharmacy, there's certain things you can't buy because they're going to say, hey, you might use this and cook meth, or you might use this and cook blah, blah, blah. So that doesn't exist yet. So people will learn to cook it themselves eventually. And so the CIA is not the only people doing LSD, but they definitely fueled the fire because they thought, okay, we need to find out everything we can about LSD. If we can use it to manipulate people, if we can use it to program assassins, if we can use it to make somebody into a double agent and make them forget about it later. The idea is that you would do anything to break somebody's mind and then reprogram them because maybe they'd get so high that you could reprogram them more easily. You know, what combination of drugs and stimuli like electrodes and opium or whatever, what combination can I do to make somebody do something? And it was just off the wall, crazy. You know, if they could figure out any way to make anybody do anything, then that was something they thought was valuable for covert operations, counterintelligence, double agents, interrogations. And this goes on for years. And one of the things that's really consequential is that they have a shell company. They have a front company that is funding LSD research. So there are a lot of doctors and scientists who get money and or LSD from the government to do LSD research. And they even pay Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical company still in business today, millions of dollars adjusted for inflation to mass produce LSD in, quote, tonnage quantities.
Wow.
So a drop of LSD is a hit. So tons of LSD is an insane amount that you could use to get the entire country high.
Wow.
And they kind of did because they just gave drugs to people with no oversight. Like I said, only a few dozen people knew about this. So there's a lot that just slipped through the cracks. There are a lot of people who are doing weird tests with drugs and torture, and no one is coming in and saying, hey, maybe you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, just no oversight at all.
Yeah, there's giving money and drugs to people, and it's all over the place, but they're not the only ones doing it.
And so also it's very disorganized too, it sounds like. Like, it's not this, you know, very secret thing happening in one room. It's more like this free for all. Am I getting that right?
Sort of. It's not a lot of people who are proper with the CIA, but they are just, like I said, you know, and you have, one thing you have to know about the CIA in the early years, this is before, not just before oversight, this is happening right after World War II, when the United States is rebuilding Western Europe with the Marshall Plan. The CIA got to tap that money. They got to put a spigot on that river of cash and take as much as they wanted.
So they had
an unlimited river of cash, no oversight. And Congress could, they had oversight powers, they just didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
So before 1975 in the Church Committee, the Armed Services Committee, and there were people in the Senate, like, again, it's the generational thing with deference to authority.
Right.
People just didn't care. They didn't want to know. They thought, okay, we're America, we're fighting communism, go do it. And they just didn't care. So it's really in the, you know, only after the Church Committee that people start to pay attention.
Right. And so who were being like non-consensually dosed with LSD for the most part? Because I've heard a lot of different types of people listed who were these kind of people who were subjects of these, you know, quote unquote experiments.
Oh yeah, there were so many people all around the world. And the most we know about comes from Canada, because Canada, there are people who were survivors of these drug and torture tests who sued the CIA and won. They had to disclose information. They had a settlement. They gave them millions of dollars. That hasn't happened in the United States, because people would complain. They go to a judge. CIA would go to the judge and say, hey, this is a matter of national security. Don't look into this. And that would pretty much be it. And it's important to remember, right around the time of Watergate in 1973, Richard Nixon is leaning on Richard Helms, who was the director of the CIA at the time and was interviewed by the Church Committee. He's leaning on Richard Helms to give him some of the CIA's secret cash money. He says, I want $1 million from the black budget so I can bribe the Watergate burglars not to testify against me. And Richard Helms says, no, I can't do that because everyone will know I gave you the money.
Mm.
And so Richard Nixon fires Richard Helms. On his way out the door, Richard Helms was involved with MKUltra. And so was a man named Sidney Gottlieb. Sidney Gottlieb was kind of like, people familiar with James Bond, he was basically Q. He was the mad scientist of the early years of the CIA. He was in charge of poisons, drugs, gadgets, and he was with the agency since 1953. So he was dropped right in the middle of MKUltra, and he was one of the only people who had any actual scientific experience in MKUltra. Like, he was a chemist. He wasn't a doctor. There was an allergist, a guy who had, you know, was an allergy specialist. But I don't think there were any actual doctors who worked on MKUltra. You probably should have a couple of those.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. So Richard Helms and Sidney Gottlieb say, Sidney Gottlieb says, okay, you have been my bureaucratic protector for years and years. I'm going to quit with you, because if I stick around, Richard Nixon is going to hang me out to dry.
Mm-hmm.
So Richard Helms sends Sidney Gottlieb down to the CIA warehouse and says, shred all the MKUltra records.
Okay.
And so they shred like 7 crates of documents. The warehouse director says, are you sure you're supposed to be doing this? Destroying federal records is a felony. And he says, yes, do it. The CIA director says, do it. I'm going to stand here and watch you do it. So he does it. And they shred 7 crates of documents. So most of the evidence of MKUltra is gone.
Ugh.
But after the Church Committee, they name names. Well, not names of agents. This is very important. They don't name the names of agents. They don't break anybody's cover. But they do name the names of programs, which is very important. Because if you make a Freedom of Information request, which people do, they name MKUltra, they name Bluebird, they name Artichoke. These are the programs where they drugged and tortured people.
Mm-hmm.
And they get a lot of records over the years. And, you know, the families of victims also make lawsuits and they do research and they find things. And so this is the legacy of the Church Committee, is that people do tons and tons of research over 50 years and they learn more and more and more. But most of the records are gone.
Wow.
Because of that.
Yeah.
But there are quite a lot of people who were drugged and tortured in prisons, in clinics, in schools, you know, universities.
Yeah.
You know, there's many, many universities who did some sort of LSD research with either drugs or funding from the government. There are people who were drugged overseas. It's very important to mention that the CIA is only allowed to operate outside the United States. That is one of the few things they're explicitly directed to do. They weren't even supposed to be doing things inside the United States.
Right.
You know, like actually one of the people who said he was drugged by MKUltra was the Boston crime boss, Whitey Bulger.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And he was in a prison where they were giving people tons and tons of LSD. Like in prisons is some of the worst examples where they kept people high on LSD for weeks.
Ugh.
Just to see what would happen.
Just my nightmare. Yeah.
And it's really horrible stuff. And like I mentioned, anywhere the U.S. Army is, South Vietnam, in the Panama Canal Zone, the United States had a military base there. In occupied Germany and occupied Korea and occupied Japan, you know, they had black sites where God knows what happened. You know, prisoners of war were tortured and drugged and we have no idea. But, you know, they did. There are people who said, hey, some crazy stuff happened, even if they can't go into details. So there's a lot of people who were hurt by this, but it's very hard to name actual names.
Wow. Yeah, I can't believe that's still true to this day, too. Wow. Okay. It's so wild.
More after this. You ever notice how finding time and energy to do the most basic human necessity, eat literal food, has become just another exhausting task jammed into our increasingly inhuman schedules? Well, your spring can be a little more stress-free with Factor. Factor will provide you with delicious, never frozen, ready to eat gourmet meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Each week, you get to choose from a menu of 35 options to create your perfect breakfast, lunch, or dinner with absolutely no prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. And Factor makes sure you get exactly what you want. You can tailor deliveries to your schedule and customize how many meals you want each and every week, and you can pause anytime. So just head to factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 and use code AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code AmericanHysteria50 at factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check out Factor today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And now back to the show. So moving from MKUltra to another kind of like CIA operation happening domestically, we can look at the surveillance as well as some darker aspects of the reaction from the government to the leftist movements that were happening throughout the 60s and 70s. And I know that one of the big revelations of the Church Committee was this thing that we have talked about several times on our show called COINTELPRO. Would you want to give us a brief into what that was and how that manifested in the Church Committee?
Absolutely. Yeah. A very important thing that also happened around the time of the Church Committee in 1975 is that there had only been one director of the FBI. Like, you know who it is. It's J. Edgar Hoover. And he died in 1972. So
tragic. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone was eager to jump on his corpse and say, it's his fault. It's his fault. It's all his fault. He made us do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was if he had lived, this committee would not have happened because there were previous attempts to investigate the CIA and the FBI. J. Edgar Hoover was one of the people who would stop them every single time.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
And yeah, J. Edgar Hoover was in charge of the Bureau of Investigation and the Federal Bureau of Investigation for 48 years under 8 presidents. He is the most powerful unelected American ever.
Yeah.
And so he was incredibly petty. He's like the ultimate swamp creature.
You know, yeah, right.
He's the guy who would go to a DC happy hour with his lanyard around his neck. I'm the assistant vice president to the vice president to the vice president. I'm an important government person. You know, he loved this stuff.
Yeah.
So he should have been in charge of something. He was organized, but really he was also a very petty, petty man. You know, he really just thought, I have to be the enforcer of social norms. He was one of the generational examples I mentioned. Like, you just don't question authority. He really believed in that. And so he was racist. He, you know, all of his prejudices played out. And he just basically said, people shouldn't be protesting war. People should not be asking for civil rights. You know, women should not be asking for civil rights. You know, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So he launched counter-surveillance, you know, COINTELPRO programs against all of these groups that he thought had to be communist or were just upsetting the social order of things as he saw them. Mm-hmm. So this becomes a focus of the Church Committee. Originally, they set out to investigate the CIA, but then Walter Mondale, who goes on to become vice president, says, hey, we should investigate the FBI too. So he's put in charge of the FBI investigation. And one of the most dramatic examples that is uncovered during the Church Committee is the FBI tries to blackmail Martin Luther King and make him kill himself.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one of the revelations that come. There's so many revelations that come out of the Church Committee that we know about the FBI. And, you know, all the COINTELPRO stuff comes out. Almost everything we know about COINTELPRO comes from the Church Committee.
Well, and just to meditate on that for a second, when I was doing a little bit of research into the Church Committee, I ended up reading that letter again, you know, a couple days ago, and it is strange. You know, I know it's like we talk about how it was a pressure campaign to get him to, you know, either commit suicide or at least at minimum stop everything that he was doing. But it is just like, it's so strangely written. It's just a very, I recommend people read it if you haven't or haven't in a long time, because knowing that it was penned by government officials, it's really bone chilling to me.
Yeah, that's how you can tell it's J. Edgar Hoover at the wheel.
Yeah, so that's his vibe.
Yeah, he's very into, you know, he was a creature of fear. He tried to scare people, but he's also just so weird.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad to know it was him probably behind the letter. So
he was such a micromanager. If there's ever any questions, like there's also the murder of Fred Hampton, who was a Black Panther activist who was killed by the FBI with the Chicago police. And if there's ever any question that J. Edgar Hoover did or didn't know anything, he was such a micromanager of everything at the Bureau. There's no way he didn't know.
Yeah, I can't imagine he didn't know. Okay, take us to COINTELPRO again.
So COINTELPRO was a vast program that began in the late 1950s, technically, like Elijah Muhammad, you know, the Black power leader who Malcolm X works for. You know, he originally the Nation of Islam, you know, it investigates him. J. Edgar Hoover had always been racist. And, you know, he even looked at Marcus Garvey in the 20s and 30s. Marcus Garvey was the big back to Africa Black power leader, you know, one of the first, you know, people of the movement, at least, you know, Black Pride, whatever you want. I don't like how they called it Black nationalists or militant groups or whatever. Let's just call it Black Pride, Black Power, whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's so he was interested in this for a very long time. So when the civil rights movement really starts to ramp up in the late 50s, early 60s, he's all over it. And Hoover just does not like it at all. You know, this is around the time that protests against the Vietnam War are picking up. And not only is he interested in this, but Lyndon Johnson, and, you know, he does this with the permission of the Kennedys, by the way. John F. Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy grant permission for J. Edgar Hoover to bug Martin Luther King.
Right.
And he just runs with that authority. And, you know, Lyndon Johnson becomes president and then Richard Nixon becomes president and the Vietnam War is escalating. And both Johnson and Nixon think, oh, all these Vietnam protesters have to be communists. They must be organized by Moscow and Beijing. Mm. Like, there's no way that average Americans would be unhappy with, you know, the way that we're running this war.
It's that generational divide thing.
It does,
like
yeah.
you mentioned. Yeah.
So they just say, we want not just the FBI to look into this. We want the CIA to look into this. Do domestic surveillance that you're specifically not supposed to do.
Right, right. Yeah.
And so they infiltrate groups. They spy on groups. They try to create ill will within groups to kind of, you know, one of the terms that you see that's really chilling with the FBI is neutralize. Like, we're going to neutralize civil rights leaders. So anything that could make, you know, prevent them from being effective, but it can also mean kill people.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So one of the examples that I always point to is Malcolm X. You know, there's conspiracy theories that the FBI killed Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. I don't think that's true, but what the FBI did do is they created so much ill will inside the Nation of Islam that one of the former members of the nation did kill Malcolm X. Now, the murder case of Malcolm X is murky. There's a couple people falsely accused or protesting that they are, but one of them, who was a former Nation of Islam member, did kill him and said he had. And that's the result of the smear campaigns that the FBI would always carry out. They would always go to groups and they would try to make all the members of the group so suspicious of each other that they would refuse to work together. And that's kind of what happened with Malcolm X, is that they poisoned his reputation so much that people were paranoid about him. And they would do this with all sorts of groups. They even did this with the Ku Klux Klan. You know, they had people infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan and women's rights groups and Vietnam protest groups, and messing with people's mail was one of their favorite things. They would open up letters. This is a lost art, like somehow opening a letter and reading it and resealing it so that no one notices. They did that all the time. And there's just all these ways that they try to mess with the, you know, poison the reputation of the groups. Like the Black Panthers, for instance, had many, many chapters across the nation, you know, in different cities, different people. It's an umbrella group that you can't generalize.
Right.
So whatever you had to say about the Black Panthers, they did have some civil rights activism and charity programs, like the free breakfast program.
Yeah.
The FBI take the time to make a fake coloring book that makes it look like the Black Panthers are giving this to kids at their free breakfast charity to make them hate police and indoctrinate them to become communists. Civil rights activism and charity programs, like the free breakfast program. The FBI creates a fake comic book that makes it look like they're trying to indoctrinate kids to hate police and become communists. Like Safeway is giving money, you know, Safeway and Jack in the Box are giving, you know, food for the Black Panther free breakfast program. And they're trying to make all of the donors of the Black Panthers stop giving them money. So this is, there's all, you know, it's a very, very broad program that lasts throughout the 1960s, pretty much until J. Edgar Hoover dies in 1972.
Wow, man.
It's weird.
That is so weird. Again, yeah, it's that weird.
You can find it online, by the way.
Oh, I will. Well, please, everyone go find it online. Wow. Okay. So that's a lot of internal propaganda, I would say. Like they were creating images of groups that were inconsistent with who they actually were and what they were actually doing.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, the Church Committee spent most of its FBI investigation on how the Kennedys and the Johnson administration allowed J. Edgar Hoover to spy on Martin Luther King. And the big revelation was that the FBI tried to make Martin Luther King kill himself. But the other big revelation about the FBI was that they were involved in the murder of Black Panther activist Fred Hampton, who was only 21 years old when he was killed in Chicago. And the Chicago police, they had a floor plan set up of the house where he was staying, and they knew where he was going to be. And they basically planned a hit on him. And if you look at the ballistics reports of the killing, it's just crazy. Where there's one gun that goes off, where the guard at the door, his gun goes off, hits nobody, and the police fire all the rest of the bullets.
Yeah.
And so this is an assassination of a civil rights leader, of Fred Hampton. And they go into that, but one of the few Black lawyers on the Church Committee, a man named Arthur Jefferson, wanted the Church Committee to go deeper, but because of time constraints, and also I think because of the politics and the generational deference to authority, there was less of the generational deference to authority on the Church Committee. But I think it was, you know, police were just as politically influential back in the 1970s as they are today. And they would have had to investigate the Chicago police if they had done that. So, you know, there were people pushing for a deeper investigation of the Black Panthers, but there was enough released that most of the really horrible things that we know about COINTELPRO today came from the Church Committee.
Okay. So in addition to this surveillance of these leftist groups, I believe there was like more of a general surveillance program that was uncovered during the Church Committee. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. One of the big discoveries of the Church Committee was that the NSA existed. People didn't know that. So the National Security Agency was created specifically to do signals intelligence, to collect overseas communications, because, like, you know, the FBI is a domestic law enforcement agency, the CIA and the NSA are definitely international because J. Edgar Hoover was around. He was already powerful by 1947 when the CIA was created. So President Truman specifically did not want to have another J. Edgar Hoover on his hands. He did not want the CIA to become a secret police. So they explicitly said no domestic surveillance. But during the Vietnam War, the CIA is doing domestic surveillance in, it's worth mentioning, the Marvel movies villains are called Hydra. Mm-hmm. Guess what the name of the CIA's domestic surveillance program is called?
Hydra. Hey, I got it.
It's the computer that they use to compile all of the information on the leftist groups.
Wow.
So this is, I don't know if that's where they get the name from, but I think that it's, you know, all of these conspiracy theories that come out of the Church Committee find their way into film and television in like Stranger Things, Captain America. There's so many examples where you can find them. But it's just worth briefly mentioning that that's, I think that that may be one of the ties for the name Hydra.
Interesting. Wow. Okay.
Because it's related to the CIA's domestic intelligence. And they keep telling the president, hey, we have no evidence that Moscow and Beijing are directing the Vietnam protests. And Johnson and Nixon just say, you're not doing your jobs. Go try harder. They just won't believe it.
Yeah.
But the other big domestic surveillance discovery is that the National Security Agency existed. They did not know about this. Most people just didn't know that it existed because there was no oversight and it was kind of an arcane agency. So they talk to people who used to work with the agency and they find out more and more and more. You know, they're getting access to classified records, which is really interesting. They spend months trying to get access to these records and they have to dig and dig and they become sleuths, really. They become investigators and they have to find the people who are involved. And they eventually do find the people involved with the NSA and they're told about the operations. Like, this is pre-internet. This is the 1950s, 60s, early 70s. So the way that they did it was they would go to telegraph offices and they would have somebody at telegraph offices take pictures of international telegrams.
Uh-huh.
And they would have these rail cars of paper that they would send back and try to analyze. So just like today, they have, you know, their solution for looking for a needle in the haystack is to take the whole haystack and hope they find something.
Right.
And it's just crazy the way that they do it.
Wow.
And the CIA is also doing a domestic surveillance program on Americans where I think what is now JFK Airport in New York City, they're going through people's international mail at New York Airport. So the COINTELPRO and CIA domestic surveillance of the Vietnam War is the main domestic surveillance. But there's also a lot of surveillance that people simply didn't know about, especially with international communications. And so today we have the FISA court, which is one of the big reforms that comes out of the Church Committee in response to these revelations that the NSA had this vast surveillance apparatus that could be turned on Americans if they wanted to. There's video of Frank Church and the Church Committee hearings online also. And Frank Church does an interview that says, this is the abyss from which there was no return.
Wow.
If the intelligence agencies ever use their surveillance power, they could become a secret police. They work for the president. If the president was somebody who really, you know, there's examples that, you know, Johnson and Nixon tried to do this. And if they'd gone even further, you know, Frank Church tells people this is the abyss from which there is no return. So this is the first time that Americans are really aware that their government has these vast surveillance powers.
Right. So what was the response from everyday Americans? Like, how well publicized were these revelations from the Church Committee? And in general, how did the country deal with whatever information actually reached them?
Oh, it was a huge sensation. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it was, you know, these were televised. There were political cartoons being made about it. All this press coverage. It's one of the most interesting things. It does, somehow doesn't get as much attention as Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to some extent by 1975, people are a little bit jaded and tired of government scandal.
Sure.
In 1974 and 1976, for instance, there was the lowest voter turnout in decades because people are so fed up with government, they just stay home and don't vote.
Right.
So there's kind of a jaded response by the American people at this point, but they do get, the Church Committee gets a ton of press coverage because it's so dramatic about assassination attempts and surveillance and COINTELPRO because J. Edgar Hoover is gone. So the FBI investigation is really, really damning because you can get the most out of it. You know, the CIA pushes back. There are people like the former director, Richard Helms, refuses to talk to the Church Committee, but there's a current director, William Colby, of the CIA who does talk to the Church Committee, and he's very, very forthcoming, and he believes that Congress has a right to know this stuff. And so the Church Committee is successful in large part because of William Colby. And William Colby gets replaced by future President George H.W. Bush, by the way, because he talks to the Church Committee, because he's so forthcoming about all this. So there is quite a lot of press coverage, but I think in hindsight, there are like we can relate to this today. There's so much crazy news coming out of the government and global politics in the 1970s that many Americans, I think, have kind of checked out.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But at the same time, there is a lot of press coverage.
Right. Wow. Okay. So we've kind of looked internally with the Church Committee, and I also would love to talk about what was discovered about the CIA's activities in other countries, including coups, assassinations, and these really impactful events that really changed the course of world history. Could you tell us what was revealed during the Church Committee about what the CIA was up to?
Well, the most dramatic revelation that came out of the Church Committee that you've probably heard of is the CIA's attempt to kill Fidel Castro, the Cuban leader, with help from the American mafia.
It's so wild.
It grabs all the headlines because it's got the mafia, it's got the Kennedys. The Kennedys are involved. So, yeah, I have to go into this because it begins under Eisenhower. Most of the crazy stuff the CIA did, like the worst, craziest stuff, was the 1950s when Allen Dulles was in charge. I had mentioned he comes from an incredibly rich, connected family. He's very arrogant. You know, the CIA works for the president. The main job of the CIA is to collect intelligence. And to this day, the CIA gives the president a brief every morning. Here's a folder of things you need to know. Here are threats. Here are risks. Here's interesting information you need to know about the world to begin your day. That's the main job of the CIA. It was created as a brain trust. It's a civilian agency, by the way. It's not a military agency. It's not supposed to go around killing people. They're supposed to be spies. They're supposed to collect intelligence. But for most of the 1950s, they are really into covert action, covert operations, assassinations, coups, MKUltra, sabotage attempts, crazy stuff. And Allen Dulles is all over this, you know, and he kind of has this entitlement about him that future directors don't have, which is why I hate him so much, is because he's just so arrogant. And Dwight Eisenhower, who had never been a politician before, I think this plays a role. He kind of lets the CIA do what it wants. And he had also run World War II, ran the Western Allies. And so he didn't want to have a war with the Soviet Union. So he thought, okay, let's have a covert war and let's try to undermine them. You know, he thought that the CIA could be the unseen hand of the president instead of the right hand, which is the military. You could use the sinister left hand. No offense to left-handers out there, but that's the idea. That's the way he looks at it, which is why the 1950s is filled with examples of crazy stuff the CIA should not be doing. And one of them is plotting to kill Fidel Castro. And they get this idea that they don't always want to do things directly. They want to have proxies. They want to try to get people in other countries who are upset with the government or people who can be bribed, people who want a promotion, people who want to be in charge. You know, find somebody else to do your dirty work. So the CIA rarely does stuff itself. They always try to do it secondhand. They try to help other people do stuff to stage a coup, to do an assassination. So they thought, let's get the mafia. The mafia knows people in Cuba because the mafia had casinos in Cuba. And when Fidel Castro comes to power, he shuts down the casinos and the mafia is not happy about that. So they thought, okay, we have a common enemy. Wow. The mafia knows people. They know how to kill people. So they reach out to a gangster named Johnny Roselli, who ropes in Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana and Tampa mob boss Sandro Trafficante to get together. And, you know, they kind of plan an assassination in Miami. A few CIA officers get together with them in Miami in the Fontainebleau Hotel, and they basically plan to poison Fidel Castro.
Wow.
Sidney Gottlieb, the guy who was working with MKUltra, he makes poison pills to poison Fidel Castro. They use butolinum poison. It is a concentrated dose of botulism, you know, so it's going to give, it's a nerve, it, you know, it will kill people slow enough that the assassin could escape, but it's lethal. And the CIA has stockpiled tons and tons of poisons. They were also big fans of shellfish toxin. One of the most famous images of the Church Committee is there was a dart gun that was made, apparently never used, that would contain darts filled with shellfish toxin.
Oh my God.
So they had planned all this stuff, but yeah. The CIA is not very good at killing people, apparently.
Okay, well, I guess that's good. Yeah.
You know, the flights of drones that they use today are much more effective. I wouldn't call them effective, but, you know, the drone attacks today cause a lot of collateral damage. The CIA is also not supposed to be doing that. You know, they've loopholed their way into it.
Yeah.
But especially in the earlier years of the CIA, they're not very good. They try to do things and they're not very good at them. You know, they should have stuck to more intelligence gathering.
Yeah. It's very bumbling. There's like a very bumbling vibe about them.
It's a bunch of rich white guys trying to do stuff. And they think they're a constant threat of the CIA is they think they're smarter than they actually are.
Right. Right.
And so they get the mafia to pass on these poison pills to people inside Cuba who could poison Fidel Castro. They try a few times. It doesn't work. And they're trying to do it before the Bay of Pigs invasion, which is another CIA debacle.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan Dulles, even within the CIA, there are people who were warning the Bay of Pigs' invasion is a bad idea. They get a bunch of Cuban exiles together. They train them as a brigade to invade Cuba. Again, they don't want Americans directly involved.
Right.
The invasion would have failed anyway, even if they had killed him, because it was such a bad plan. Alan Dulles completely ignores it. But it's such a disaster that John F. Kennedy finally fires Alan Dulles.
Wow.
But, you know, Eisenhower and Kennedy both know about the plots to kill Fidel Castro, and Kennedy, especially Bobby Kennedy, keeps them going. Bobby Kennedy is really into it. Bobby Kennedy expands it, and they build a big headquarters in southern Florida called JM Wave, which, you know, carries out sabotage attempts and, you know, any kind of covert action to mess with Cuba and Castro's government. They try this for years. But then the Cuban Missile Crisis happens, and in exchange for that, you know, part of the deal after the Cuban Missile Crisis is that they'll stop trying to invade Cuba. So they kind of put the assassination attempts on the back burner for a while. They don't completely stop, you know, but the main thrust of trying to kill Fidel Castro is the end of the 1950s and the early 1960s, which is uncovered by the Church Committee. And there's all sorts of weird tangential conspiracies that they look into, like, was Frank Sinatra involved somehow?
Wow.
Was John F. Kennedy's mistress, Judith Campbell, involved somehow? Because Judith Campbell, who had been recently divorced at the time, was also dating Sam Giancana, who was one of the people in the plot to kill Fidel Castro.
Wow.
Did she pass messages to Kennedy? And Kennedy definitely knew about this. We go into it that J. Edgar Hoover somehow finds out that Judith Campbell is dating Sam Giancana and he's dating John F. Kennedy. So that kind of is the smoking gun that Kennedy, and he meets with Kennedy. There's not a record about what they discuss, but there's a briefing materials that Hoover takes to the lunch he has with Kennedy, and Judith Campbell's mentioned. So this is kind of a smoking gun that, you know, Hoover now has blackmail material on John F. Kennedy. So he's allowed to do his surveillance of Martin Luther King. He's allowed to do COINTELPRO. And it also shows that Kennedy knew about the plots to kill Fidel Castro. So this is how the Kennedys are involved.
Okay.
You know, the plots to kill Fidel Castro is one of the big ways that the Kennedys are featured in our book.
Ah, these are just massive bombshells. Just all in one committee. It's so incredible. And how long did these hearings last for?
The hearings didn't last as long. The arc of the committee is that the committee is created in 1975. They get together a plan because there had already been some disclosures in the press by a reporter named Seymour Hersh, especially about internal leaks from the CIA about domestic surveillance of civil rights groups and protesters of the Vietnam War, which the CIA definitely was not supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also, you know, leaks about the existence of the Family Jewels report. So I had mentioned that Richard Helms was fired by Richard Nixon. So Richard Nixon puts in charge of the CIA his man, James Schlesinger. And James Schlesinger is sent to basically be the hatchet man of the CIA. He fires more people at the agency than any other director ever.
Mm-hmm.
So there's tons and tons of people who are pushed out. And he also is worried about the agency making the president look bad, because the CIA works for the president. Even if the president doesn't know everything, the buck stops there. They're working for the president, full stop. So like, did Ronald Reagan know about Iran-Contra? Did someone know about that? Doesn't matter. They work for him. They work for the president. Mm-hmm. So Nixon is worried that the CIA is going to make him look bad. So he, James Schlesinger, puts out an order to everyone in the agency and says, I want you to send me examples of everything the CIA has done that could potentially be illegal, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And they do. And there's this gigantic report of all of these things the CIA did that might have been illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this ticking time bomb in the CIA. You know, they just put, he puts it in his desk and it just sits there. And James Schlesinger isn't in the post for very long. He gets rotated out and William Colby becomes the CIA director. And William Colby had a storied history with the agency. He was in charge of the Phoenix program in the Vietnam War, which is basically the CIA's inquisition looking for communist spies in Vietnam. And tens of thousands of people were killed with very little evidence. And so he's probably guilty about that by 1975. So he probably, you know, he was not a huge fan of the Vietnam War, but he just did it because that was his job.
Right.
So by the time the Church Committee's come around, he's ready to talk and believes Congress has a right to know about things. So he's sitting on the Family Jewels report. It gets out to the press that this report exists. And so the Church Committee has kind of a roadmap of what to do. And there's also disclosures in the press that Gerald Ford mentions that there were attempted assassinations by the CIA. So there's all these whispers already by the time the committee is going. And they say, okay, let's focus on the attempted assassinations. That will get a lot of headlines because the goal is to get Americans' attention to focus on the dramatic examples. They only have a few months to do everything. Like, I mean, everything. And they have to pick.
Yeah.
So they say assassination sounds pretty dramatic. They're definitely not supposed to be doing that. And so they dig into five examples. One of them is the plot to kill Fidel Castro.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Family Jewels report becomes part of the CIA records. So they go to, you know, they have a hearing where William Colby is there and he's going through notes and they say, hey, can I have a copy of that big report you've got in front of you? And so the search committee gets a copy of the Family Jewels report. It is really thorough with all of these examples, and that becomes a big roadmap for the committee for its investigations. And there's a very bipartisan effort in the committee. There's Republican Senator John Tower and Democratic Senator Frank Church both go to the White House and they say, we are united and we want classified documents. So the Ford administration has to cooperate because, you know, he knows that there's a bipartisan effort to get these documents. And so he decides to cooperate with the Senate. And they get mountains and mountains of documents. All of these staffers on the committee are digging and digging and doing interviews. And there's like a river of information. They have to be very judicious about it. Another dramatic example of the Church Committee's research is the murder of Congolese leader Patrice Lumumba, which I think the Congo crisis in 1960 is the starting gun of the Cold War in Africa, because Congo was and is a vital strategic nation where there's basically every natural resource you could think of, from uranium to diamonds, coltan, oil was discovered years after that. It's basically Wakanda from Black Panther. Mm-hmm. It is directly inspiring, you know, Wakanda from Black Panther, because Wakanda in the Marvel comic books has, you know, vibranium, which is, it's only found there. So it is a vast reserves of natural resources. And so that's why the CIA was so interested in the loyalties of Congo. And this is kind of, to me, an example of how the CIA operated and how the State Department operated. But it's not just a deep state. This is the whole government here. Mm-hmm. The President Eisenhower, the State Department, the CIA, they're all worried about Patrice Lumumba because he's a little bit too independent.
Mm.
He wants to work with the United States. He's popularly elected. He wants to trade with the United States. You know, Belgium had been the colonial ruler of Congo for decades, and they were brutal colonial oppressors. And so he's just eager for Congo to be independent. He believes in a united Africa, self-reliant Africa, but that's not deferential enough for the U.S. government. They say, you have to be our friend. You're either with us or against us. That's their mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, to this day, there are rich people and governments that are influencing Congo right after its independence in 1960. And there is a civil war that sparks pretty much immediately. And after less than 2 months, the CIA and the State Department decide, okay, we need to put one of our people in charge. And so Joseph Mobutu, who's a who's an officer in the Congolese army, approaches the only CIA agent in Congo and says, if you give me money to bribe officers, I'll stage a coup and then I'll become the leader and I'll do what you want, basically.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And they do. And they give him bribe money and Mobutu becomes dictator for decades afterwards. He becomes a kleptomaniac dictator and the CIA's man in Africa. So Patrice Lumumba was ousted in the coup. But even after that, they think that he's so popular and he's such a good speaker that they try to have him killed. And at the same time, Sidney Gottlieb is making poison pills to kill Fidel Castro. He also flies to Congo with the same poison to kill Patrice Lumumba.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, this busy year in 1960.
Yes.
I tell you. And so they try to kill him, but he's being protected by United Nations guards because the United Nations, you know, basically does what the United States wants in 1960, because the United States will never be as powerful or influential ever again as we were in the 1950s, mm-hmm. because everyone else was bombed out from World War II. We had all the money. We built the United Nations in New York City. They mostly did what we said. And you can't expect that anymore. You know, industries have been rebuilt. Countries are no longer reliant on U.S. money the way that they used to be. So, but, you know, they mostly did what the United States wanted, but they drew the line at killing a foreign leader mm-hmm. because they're trying to create a succession that's semi-lawful, but they keep trying to kill him. But in the end, they make it easier for Joseph Mobutu to arrange to have him killed. So they find out that Mobutu is going to transfer Lumumba into the hands of one of the factions that hates Lumumba, and he ends up getting murdered. And the church committee pulls some punches in its reports, and they say, this happened, that happened, this happened. But that doesn't mean the government is responsible.
Right, right.
They kind of pull their punches right at the end. Mm-hmm. But you know, you can tell that the government is responsible. You know, the government knew enough to know that this was going to happen, even if they didn't do it themselves. They tried to kill him, and they knew that he was going to be killed, but they didn't do anything to stop it. And that's kind of an example of how the CIA operated. If you think of a CIA coup, if you think of trying to fund an insurgency in a government they don't like, that's kind of how they operate.
Right.
You know, they will find people who can be bribed. They will try to have proxies do it. You know, at least that's the way they did it during the Cold War. It's less overt today, mm-hmm. but some of the playbook is still in use. So it's just kind of an interesting case example to keep in mind there.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Lumumba example is really damning to me because Congo should be one of the richest nations in the world, and it's not, partly because outside investors or governments will interfere in its affairs, and everyone is always trying to get a piece of the diamonds or the mining interests. And, you know, it's just that people are always trying to influence it with a militia or something or other. It's just, that's just an example of, you know, that has been continuing for, you know, hundreds of years, but, you know, there's a brief moment in 1960 where that might have become less of a problem, at least. And the CIA prevented that from happening.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the Family Jewels report is really a roadmap for the Church Committee on its investigations. And then they dig and dig and find more information and do all these interviews. And it's just so overwhelming. We interviewed every member we could, you know, most of the members of the Church Committee who are still with us talked to us, and they laid out this, you know, this crazy atmosphere where people are just kind of learning as they go. Nobody was really an expert in the CIA, and everybody was willing to talk about one thing or another. It's just such a fascinating story of just the people working on the committee, you know, just had so many crazy stories to tell.
Wow. I mean, I can't imagine what it was like to talk about this with the people who are actually part of it. It's just a once in a lifetime book you've written, I believe.
More after this. And now, back to the show.
I think that my book that I wrote with my father is also about the life of Senator Frank Church, his political life from 1957 to 1981. Uh-huh. And throughout that time, he worked on so many issues that were so ahead of their time, like corporate bribery is one example. You know, just read the book. There's so many examples where he was more right than he knew, like corporate bribery. At the same time he's doing the Church Committee in 1975, he's also doing the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Corporate Bribery of Foreign Governments. It used to be legal for a United States company to bribe a foreign government.
Wow.
And it is not anymore because of Frank Church. Because, you know, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was passed in response to his investigations. And it was just so endemic that they thought, okay, we have to explicitly say that this is illegal and you can't do that, which kind of is an example of regulation.
Right.
If it's not explicitly illegal, companies might do it. So that's kind of, you know, a lesson learned.
Yeah. So could you talk a little bit more about how this committee changed the landscape of politics and what's legal and what's not, and kind of the legacy of Frank Church and the Church Committee?
Yeah, the Church Committee is his most famous legacy, but he had 24 years of service in the U.S. Senate and did so much, from civil rights to corporate bribery to opposing the Vietnam War to diplomatic treaties. So the career of Senator Frank Church is really, it's worth reading about, because there's so much that is, you know, ahead of its time and so important for our world today, including the discovery of corporate bribery of foreign governments. And the creation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is definitely one of his other legacies. Mm-hmm. He's doing that in 1975, the same time he's doing the Church Committee. So he had an incredibly busy year.
Wow. I should say so. Okay. Well, what do you think, Tom, from writing this book, from everything that you've learned, from everything you've told us today, what do you think are some of the most important lessons that we should glean from all of these secret programs, from the things that, you know, our government may be capable of behind closed doors? What do you think are the most important lessons that you learned that you would like to impart to our audience and to me?
I think it's important that we have a system of checks and balances in our government. You know, we have the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. And the legacy of Frank Church is really reasserting the power of the legislative branch, because the CIA is an arm of the executive branch, where they work for the president. The president is able to control the military and the federal agencies, and Congress is supposed to control the purse strings and supposed to have some oversight power there. And Frank Church, in many, many things he did, including the Church Committee, reasserted the power of Congress to at least know about these things and have the opportunity to oppose them, and, you know, in whatever way that it can. And including by saying, no, you can't have money to mass produce LSD.
Sure. So, Tom, you have obviously studied what I consider like the roots of so many modern conspiracy theories that we hear that we can, you know, assume are not true, or at least mostly untrue. But, you know, you are studying real true conspiracies. And so I wonder how, in a world where we both are, you know, inundated with sort of propaganda on a daily basis, but also in this new realm, kind of in this post-Trump feeling that we want to like put all this trust back into our institutions, make sure, you know, because we're so afraid of what could happen if these institutions were to fail under more of a, you know, dictator type figure. But I think sometimes I get concerned that we are rejecting the fact that there are conspiracies completely because we don't want to go down the rabbit hole that so many other people have gone down. So what is your perspective on kind of where we are at with conspiracy theories in respect to all of the research and all the things that you know from your life's work?
I think that the Church Committee is the birthplace of every American conspiracy, because this is where the facts come from. You know, every good conspiracy needs facts to help it grow. People will say, this is true, so that must be true, and that must be true. And this is where, like I said, there's thousands and thousands of pages that came from the Church Committee that name the names of programs, and they name dates, and they name countries affected. And so every conspiracy theorist over the past 50 years must have read these reports. There's so many facts there that have given rise to, like, the plot to kill Fidel Castro with the help of the mafia led to conspiracies that the mafia and or Castro killed John F. Kennedy in response.
Mm, okay.
And that was fueled in part by Johnny Rosselli, who was the go-between, you know, between the mafia and the CIA. He wanted the CIA to intervene on his deportation case. Mm-hmm. So he was born in Italy. And when they found out, you know, what his real name was, Filippo Sacco. He's from Italy. So they said, okay, we can deport you now because we can prove it. They can't do it. Mm-hmm. This is what ICE is doing, is that if they can't prove who you are, they can't find where you're from in another country, they can't send you out. They can't deport you. Mm-hmm. But they found out who he was and where he's from, and they say, okay, we can deport you now. And the CIA case, that's one of the reasons that this conspiracy that Castro killed John F. Kennedy in response to the murder plot came about, is because he was trying to feed those rumors. He was trying to, you know, intimidate the CIA to, so that's one of the reasons people had their agendas to kind of fuel that rumor. But it's also because the Warren Commission didn't do a good job in 1964 when they investigated it. Allen Dulles and J. Edgar Hoover are both on the Warren Commission, and they didn't want to be blamed for it. Protecting the president is your job. And if you don't, they're going to blame you. So they didn't disclose all this information. J. Edgar Hoover's not on the committee, but he's influencing it. And so there was a cover up by the FBI and the CIA to kind of deflect blame. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good example of how a conspiracy really looks. It's not that the government does something, it's that they don't tell the whole truth.
Right.
And because they don't tell the whole truth, people think, okay, what else aren't you telling us? You must be leaving something else important out. And that's kind of a tie in there. I think one of the lessons of the Church Committee is that the CIA was not a rogue elephant. This is a term that Frank Church uses early in the committee. Mm-hmm. Was the CIA a rogue elephant? Was the CIA a deep state? Was it a cabal of people plotting to do things? But it turns out quite the opposite. The presidents, you know, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, they all knew what was going on. They were working for the president. It's not a deep state. It's the whole government. Mm-hmm. Now, Congress didn't know, which is, you know, bad, but
I'd say,
the executive branch knew what was going on, because not only was the president involved, federal agencies were involved. The CIA or the FBI called up the IRS, for example, and they said, hey, I don't like this person. I want to see their tax returns. Okie doke, here you go.
Right.
Hey, I want to know who's buying LSD, and maybe I can get a bunch of your throwaway drugs, Food and Drug Administration. Okie doke, here you go. Go enjoy torturing people.
Right.
You know, they don't know everything, but they just, if they called up someone, they would get stuff from all the other federal agencies. So the executive branch, even if Congress wasn't involved, the executive branch was all involved. It was all together. So that's kind of an example, is like, there isn't really a deep state. They, you know, they were abusing powers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The idea of the deep state was basically prevented by the Church Committee because Congress wasn't part of the equation. You know, all three branches have to have a say or have to be able to balance each other out. And the executive branch was acting unilaterally. So that's why Congress needs to be involved, so that at least our elected representatives can hear classified briefings and say, no, that's a bad idea. Don't do that. But there's also limits to that. Like, a very recent example is Senator Ron Wyden was on the Senate Intelligence Committee when he was being briefed about the NSA's domestic spying during the Bush administration. And, you know, so he hears about this in a closed door hearing, but in a public hearing, he asked the same official, you know, and not remembering the question exactly, but he basically says, does the NSA spy on Americans? And he says, no. And Wyden knows that he's lying, but he can't call him on it because that's the deal. It's a classified briefing. He can't tell anybody. So there's limits to what the House and Senate Intelligence Committees can do. You know, they can refuse funding. They can criticize the agencies behind closed doors. But if they hear something they don't like, they can't just go and tell people.
Right.
It's important to remember that the CIA and the federal agencies pretty much do what they want. They know they're being watched now because of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. The Church Committee is a watershed moment where many of the abuses of power from the days before oversight come out. But you have to remember that the Iran-Contra scandal also happens less than a decade after the Church Committee. Hmm. And Congress, you know, the House and Senate Intelligence Committees refuse to fund the Contras in Nicaragua that are, you know, the militia group opposing the communist government there. You know, so the CIA says, okay, we'll get money another way. But they do know they're being watched, and they are worried about getting caught because they know that there's oversight now. But that shows that if the agencies really want to do something, they're just going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And that flies in the face of criticism that the Church Committee hobbled the spy agencies. And, you know, Ronald Reagan comes into office in the 1980s and says, I'm going to unleash the CIA. But there's really nothing to unleash. You know, oversight doesn't mean that the CIA's capabilities aren't there. that they could still do this if they wanted. They would probably get caught, but they, you know, they can still do things. It's not that Congress can stop them. They can criticize them and cut off their funding, but yeah, their capabilities are still there. And Dick Cheney has worked for the Ford administration, and he's in the book. He tried to shut down the Church Committee and prevent them from getting access to classified documents. So when he becomes vice president during the Bush administration, he is all out there saying, oh, the Church Committee did great damage to the intelligence community. But Iran-Contra alone shows just a few years after this, the CIA does what it wants anyway. You know, all of these people are out there saying, oh, don't oversee the government. Don't question the government. You know, that doesn't really stop them from doing what they want if they feel, you know, they're worried about getting caught. But if they really feel like they have to do something, they're going to do it.
Well, thank you so much, Tom. This has been very enlightening and I think a really, really valuable primer for everyone about the CIA and what was going on in the 50s, 60s, 70s and you know, what is possible if we don't have the right kinds of oversight. So thank you so much for just delivering your vast knowledge to us.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
This was American Hysteria. You can find a link to get Tom's book, The Last Honest Man, in our show notes. If you want to get more of our show, you can head to patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus, where you'll get ad-free episodes as well as bonus content, including Hysteria Home Companion, a podcast that I do with producer Miranda, where we tell you stories that were left out of the episode or stories we think that you'd really like. Most recently, we covered the FBI's designation of the Juggalos as a gang. That's patreon.com/American Hysteria or subscribe on Apple Plus. At AmericanHysteria.com, you can pick up some of our merch, or you can leave us a message on our Urban Legends hotline about a story that you remember from growing up, and we just might do an entire episode about it. You can also follow us on Instagram for lots more fun stuff at American Hysteria Podcast. Our producer and editor is Miranda Zickler, and our associate producer is Riley Swedelius Smith. And of course, I'm your host, Chelsea Weber Smith. Thanks as always for listening, and I hope you have a great week.